Greetings, my friends. Welcome to the next episode of the Mint Mob Podcast. Jason here, joined by my buddy Alex across the pond in Germany. We're going to jump into what's happening in the Goodfellas universe, but of course, we're going to check in and see what's happening in the broader crypto market and, of course, with Alex. So how you doing, buddy? What's going on your way?
Hey, man, I'm doing really good. When you just spoke, I was looking at a message I received from Lilia, who, by the way, needs some congratulations. We've seen it on the timeline. We've seen it in the Discord. A piece that she provided for the Artist Incubator has been part of an exhibition in Toronto. And it's interesting because she told me, she almost panicked when she found out, because she told me that she submitted like a folder with different illustrations to the exhibition. And she didn't know if she was allowed to, you know, send that in, and the piece being shown with her name and all that. So she was kind of panicking, and she was even sending apologies and all that stuff. So yeah, it's crazy, but of course it's totally fine, and we are very happy for her and every collector who collected the piece, Guardian of the Sun, a really beautiful one. And I remember that all the collectors love the piece. So if Lilia happens to listen to this, she probably won't, because she doesn't speak English, but congratulations. And really cool, right? Like, it's, I didn't even know that there was like a big exhibition in Toronto. Did you know about that?
The first I heard of it was when I saw the post come across with featuring her piece. So no, I was not aware. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, really cool. It looks like Viorica also got a piece that was shown there, and it looks like it took place in July 21st to 22nd. And as it was Toronto, and you're, you know, almost Canadian by heart, I figured that you could have known.
No, I didn't know. I hadn't heard of that show, but you know, there's so many, you know, little shows cropping up here and there that, I mean, it's impossible to know them all. Mm-hmm. So, but anyway, being recognized, yeah. I mean, for the work, and if she submitted a bank of work, I think it's fantastic that she got that particular piece featured, because of the pieces that she submitted for the AI, that's one of the pieces that was strongest. And it just goes to show you that art is not as subjective as people think, right? Like, something that's good is good. And that's one of those pieces that I think recognizes that for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And all the images I saw from that particular exhibition looked like there have been plenty of people, you know, looking at these pieces, and a lot of visitors. So that was definitely very cool to see. But yeah, another topic I wanted to jump into today is something I recently spent some time on. As you know, I've been preparing to have a little interview with Daniel, founder of the Alien Buddy Buds, who is going to get his first Artist Incubator piece minted on Friday, the first alien entering our little gallery. And one thing really stood out to me, how heavily Daniel has gamified the entire experience in the Alien Buddy Buds. And yeah, well, they've got NFT evolutions where you can basically combine NFTs and create a new one. They have progression systems. They have weekly battles. They have rewards for community engagement. It almost feels like playing a game around an NFT collection. So what's your first impression when you hear about a project like that?
It just depends on the implementation. I mean, coming from the sort of boom times into now, like, my big turnoff with gamification earlier was that basically it was giving you a second job. Basically, if you were part of an NFT mm-hmm. project, you would have to, you know, check in here, check in there, post this, like that, comment here. And it was all basically designed to force you to do marketing in some sort of way for the project. Because, you know, there were so many projects cropping up and so little differentiation that, you know, really people were just basically bribing you to work for them. And, you know, when I started buying NFTs, I was like, well, you know, I'm really not looking for a part-time job here. You know, I just want to show up and collect and have a good time and, you know, pick up some pieces. But when it has a real purpose outside of, you know, sort of, you know, market for us, it changes everything. It changes the psychology behind it into something that you don't necessarily want to participate in, into something that you might. And as long as it's coming from a place of, you know, this is part of, you know, like the ecosystem and how we're building it and how you advance and how you can earn different types of things, you know, within this specific collection, you know, Daniel's collection in particular, it makes a lot of sense and it's a good thing to do. It's only when it's like a take from people that it's not necessarily a bad thing. And, you know, back in that 21, 22 era, that's all it really was just stealing more of your time. And, you know, if you were in multiple projects and you had, let's say, for example, you were in, you know, a bunch of different projects, you open up Discord, you know, and there's, you know, your server list is full, there's 200 servers there, and then somehow you're expected to go through all of these servers and start, you know, like liking and tweeting and retweeting stuff. And it was just a huge take and a huge time suck. But when it's portrayed as, you know, this is how you can advance through the system, or this is how you can evolve your project or your NFT, it's completely different. So I think the psychology behind it matters more than anything. And, you know, the way that Daniel has framed that he does it in terms of evolving the pieces and, you know, giving people an opportunity to plug in and connect with one another, that's a totally different thing from previous.
Yeah, I absolutely get that. When I heard about the whole ecosystem that the Alien Buddy Buds built, it kind of reminded me of something that happened back in 2022, I think, when I was buying into a project called Miners of Mars. And they started, I actually held like 10 pieces or something, and I like the art. I think that their artist is also a drawing art for Marvel and all that stuff. So I really liked it. And they suddenly started to gamify their staking experience. So you could basically set up different type of groups and crews and send them into staking. And yeah, all these staked assets were integrated into active narrative loops where crews faced like simulated Martian hazards, like toxic gas or equipment failures and all that stuff. So all that kind of influenced how many like staking rewards you got, and you needed to be smart and put a good crew together that works well with each other. And that kind of was like, that was a big turnoff for me. Like I felt like I don't want to, like, I just want to collect, like I don't want to play a game. And I mean, that also made me think about our own approach with Goodfellas, right? We've always said that the art is the utility. We intentionally kept things relatively simple. Sure, we have the families concept, but that's really just a collecting mechanic, not a full-blown game. So do you think we're missing an opportunity by keeping things simple?
When you talk about missed opportunities, you have to realize that everything you say no to gives you the ability to say yes to something else. So you can operate from FOMO, or you can just operate from this is the focus and this is the direction. Now, could we do a better job of gamifying certain aspects? Absolutely. And do we have plans to do that? Absolutely. But it would never be like it was in those early days, and it would probably look much different from, you know, some of the things that Daniel does. But I mean, the truth is, like, anything that serves the project, we can absolutely do and should do, regardless of like personal feelings, because again, like, it's not about us. It's about, you know, mm-hmm. the community and what we want to create, right? And we're creating this thing together. You know, we're in this very experimental time frame in NFTs and Web3. So are you missing an opportunity? Maybe. But the truth is, like, if we were focused on a bunch of other things, then we wouldn't have been able to create what we've created with, like, artist negotiations and pulling in the AI and, you know, writing code and building applications and, you know, all the other things that have been accomplished. So it's one of those things where I don't necessarily frame it that way, just simply because the fact is, you know, if we had gone a different direction, or if we look at it from the standpoint of a missed opportunity, then we would basically have been saying no to some of the things that we are doing. So I think the better way to think about it is, like, Can we add something in that serves the project? Yes. What would the time frame look like? Mm-hmm. I'm not sure yet. What would the gamification look like outside of the family structure and the reward system that we're about to release next month? You know, I'm not sure. So I think just as long as what you're building serves your ultimate ends, that's the big thing that you have to focus on. And that's the thing that, you know, I've tried to continue to keep us focused on rather than get sidetracked on a bunch of different things that, mm-hmm. you know, end up being like half done, you know, especially with a small team. So I think that there's opportunity, of course, to gamify more of what we're doing. I certainly see that as something that we can dive into, but I would not want to sacrifice what we have created thus far in terms of systems and consistency and building around content and art, you know, for the sake of simply saying that we have something that looks more like another project. That wouldn't make any sense to me. So, you know, from that aspect, I don't think we've missed an opportunity. I think that ultimately, as we continue to evolve and grow the project, more opportunities will expand and open up for us. That's basically the way I look at it.
Yeah, I feel like one thing we can't deny is that gamification gives people reasons to come back every day, right? Like you've got goals, progression, rewards. There's always something happening. But at the same time, every new mechanic kind of adds complexity, right? If someone joins to the project, they suddenly have to understand evolution, rankings, battles, instead of just buying art they like. And I've even witnessed that it's kind of difficult, you know, for once new people enter the Goodfellas ecosystem. I remember when Gabor, the most recent boss, came into the project, and I had that huge conversation with him about like all the different collections we have, and you know, had to explain everything to him. So, in the end, do you think that higher barrier to entry hurts long-term adoption for projects?
Well, higher barrier to entry, that's not what we have. More of a, I think when you come into a project there, you know, it's just like if you're buying into a company or buying into, you know, an activity or a hobby, right? Like there's certain mm-hmm. aspects of that particular activity or hobby that you have to familiarize yourself with. So I think the challenge is, you know, when you've identified what your particular system's going to be and your particular focus is going to be, that you do your level best to simplify it as much as possible and make it step by step. Like if you own this, then you get that. If you do this, then you get that. You know, if you want to build a family, it looks like this, right? Like you just make it as simple as humanly possible and try to explain the idea from the 10,000 foot view in a manner that someone could grasp very quickly. And if you can do that, like you can make it as complex as you want, so long as you can communicate it in a simple way. So I think that's really what it comes down to, is being able to communicate it in a way that's easily understood. And in that way, you can mm-hmm. mitigate some of the complexities. Now, you can make it so complex that it would be extremely difficult or nearly impossible to explain to someone. And of course, you want to avoid that like the plague. So it's going to be one of those types of things where you have to find a balance. And, you know, it's going to be one of those types of things where when people come in, you really need to funnel them through a system of education. So I think you can make it really whatever you want to make it, so long as your consumer, your community, your buyer has some sort of way of really grasping what it is that you're doing, at least from a high level, very quickly.
Yeah, I totally agree. I mean, when I think about projects who try to, like, let's stick to Alien Body Butts, the project, and Daniel obviously pays a lot of attention to the art he creates as well. Like, he has so many great ideas. He has like different races, but when I see a project trying to combine gaming and art NFTs, I wonder if you know, I get the idea behind it, right? Like he probably, or any project is probably thinking, hey, why do not, you know, take best of both worlds? But in the end, you know, if you try to do two difficult things at once, it might end up in being like, you know, you do not master any of those like really, really good. Instead, you're like, you mentioned it in the beginning, you said half done, especially if you're a small company, like, can you actually build a great gaming experience around a project if you're like a one-man show, right?
Yeah, there's absolutely truth in that for sure, yeah.
Yeah, because in the end, if you actually want to play a game, you'd probably like if I want to play games, I'm not sure if I'm looking into NFT projects, because I'm, as far as I know, like, and I should know, I've never collected anything aside from loving the art. Like I always wanted to own the art, mm-hmm. and I've never really looked into like having any type of game that's being played or coming with the art. So I'd love to get collectors' opinions on that, because if I want to play a game, I'm probably looking into different directions instead of NFTs. So I'm wondering where the industry is heading. Like 5 years from now, do you think the successful NFT projects will mostly look like games, or will, you know, the strongest projects still be the ones where the art is the main focus?
I think Web3 in and of itself has a, you know, and basically the generations from Gen X on through, like they were raised on games, you know, I mean, even if you were, mm-hmm. you know, like probably even before Gen X, like, but like Gen X for sure had, you know, the Nintendo wave that was so popular in the 80s. And that sort of, you know, really created a population of people who were drawn to games. And so games have been part of the, or I should say digital video games have been part of the, you know, fabric of American life and people across the world for 50 years now. So, I mean, if you look at what people are socialized with, whether it's, you know, they're raised in a church, or whether it's, you know, they have a family dinner at the same time every day, or they have access to video games, like what they learn to live within the confines of, they're most likely going to take those experiences and bring them with them into other parts of life. So it only makes sense that in Web3 you would have tons of focus on games and gamification and Web3 video games and all the rest of it, especially now that the technology has evolved to the point where it is right now, where, you know, even game engines can be sort of vibe coded at this point, and you can, you know, create decent looking games and games that mimic those early games with a few prompts. So, you know, it only makes sense that it's part of it. Now, whether or not it's necessary, or whether or not it's, you know, something that people have to have or want to have, you know, that's a totally different question altogether. But I think that the ubiquitous nature of gaming, at least as it's existed for the last half century, is basically going to dictate that there's going to be a healthy dose of it in everything going forward, whether it's Web3 or Web2, or, you know, even, you know, having game night at your house, you know, like people love to get together and, you know, either play video games as a community, or watch TV shows as a community, or play board games as a community. So I don't think that aspect of life is going to go away no matter what.
As you speak of it, like as we, you and I, we are like coming from two different generations, I wonder, like, what role does gaming play in your life actually?
Not so much anything really. Like, you know, when I outgrew gaming, I outgrew it and I walked away from it. And then you know, my life mm-hmm. path was very different from a lot of people. You know, I live, you know, 2,000 miles from my parents. And, you know, they're on the other side of the continent. And, you know, my whole adult life has been about building businesses and finding opportunities. So I play a different game. You know, mm-hmm. I play the game of multiplying money and building projects and, you know, trying to better myself. Like, those are the games that I play. They're not digital. And I don't want to waste my life sitting in front of a screen, right? So I don't necessarily play many games. There are a few games that I have on my phone that I enjoy playing. And if I'm, you know, just, I don't know, like sleeping in or something, or hanging out with Christine in bed or something like that, we'll play some word games, or we'll play some of these, you know, puzzle type games on the phones, and we enjoy doing that. But outside of that, that's not really, it's not really a part of my life. But there are people from my generation, the Gen X generation, who are like huge into it, you know, whether it's, you know, like the modern gaming systems, you know, playing, you know, like massive multiplayer games like Call of Duty or whatever. I mean, they're huge into it. So, I mean, it's different. And a lot of these people are not necessarily like in the entrepreneurial sphere. So like they'll come home from work and they'll watch television, or they'll hang out with their kids or whatever, and they'll play games together as part of like how they wind down at the end of the night, you know. It's kind of the impression I get. But, you know, of course, that's very different from someone who's like in the Homelander generation, who basically wakes up and plays a video game for 8 hours straight. You know, that's, you know, that's something that I did when I was maybe a teenager, you know, and that would be on a very rare occasion. You know, maybe you had the cheat codes to one of the Nintendo games or something, so you had infinite lives and you would sit there and try to beat the game or something. And we would get together and do stuff like that. But, you know, that part of my life where I sit in front of a game console and play a video game for, you know, 8 or 10 hours is not something that interests me at this point. I'm more interested in creation than consumption. So for me, you know, can I create a piece of art? Can I create a business? Can I create a return on my money? Can I create a relationship? Can I get better at pickleball or weightlifting or whatever it is that I'm doing? You know, can I build a Jeep, or, you know, jet the carbs on the dirt bikes, whatever the thing is, like, you know, all of these different things you could classify as games if you wanted to, but really they're just, you know, ways that people occupy their time, so to speak. And for me, my time is very precious, and I want to spend it on things that I really, really enjoy, or things that I really feel like are going to move the needle in a positive direction for me personally. You know, I may not necessarily enjoy going to the gym and, you know, sweating my ass off, lifting weights, but it's one of those things that I do because I want to make sure that I take care of my body and that my body serves me my entire life, right? So, like, I think it just comes down to priorities. And, you know, when you're, you know, like if you're a teenager right now, a Homelander, you know, your priorities are completely different. And I was having this conversation actually on Facebook with a group of people who were talking about how parents do too much for their kids. And when I look at the generation of kids that are growing up in this community specifically, now I can't speak to other communities across the globe, but in this community specifically, parents do way too much for their kids. And the kids are super soft. They don't really have, and I'm speaking generally, there are exceptions to the rule. The kids are super soft. They don't have a lot of, I would say, like mental strength to deal with certain things. They don't do hard things, and so they don't challenge themselves in that way, at least physically. So, you know, for me, when I look at that type of stuff, I don't want to ever be one of those people who lives life sitting on a couch doing, I guess you would say, not much physically. So for me, the trade-off from sitting in front of a game console to doing something physical is not worth it, because I want to make sure that I'm like physically doing hard things, because that also trains your mind. And from there, you can build and create whatever you want. So I think there's a balance that has to be struck. And when you're young, you know, especially in those teenage years, you don't even think about that. It's just like, I'm going to eat potato chips and I'm going to drink sugar, and I'm going to sit here in front of this screen and I'm going to do this all day long. And if mommy and daddy allow that, because they're allowing you to live a quote unquote better life than they have, you know, by making everything easy on you, then I think that's a disservice.
Well, I partly agree. I partly disagree as well. Like, I don't think that it's a complete waste of time. I don't think it's any worse than, you know, watching TV or looking like on your smartphone and spending like 8 hours on TikTok and going through different reels and all that stuff. Because like you mentioned that when you were younger, you never really got into that gaming mindset. I mean, you one thing that I love that you just said is like that life is kind of like a game as well, at least to some degree, right? Like so many kids spend so many weeks or months in a game and try to level up their characters and collect experience points, whatever, instead of doing that in their real lives, right? Like you can go to the gym, you can master all those skills in real life and get a better job or build a company and try to become the main character in your own life, right? Like and treat it as a game. Obviously you cannot die and get like respawned at some point, but in the end I feel like gaming probably is on the same level as, you know, people who watch TV all day long or who you know, waste their time on smartphones and on TikTok and all that stuff. But in the end, I wouldn't necessarily try to avoid it at all costs because, like, to me, it's sometimes like maybe I'd love to get your opinion on that because to me, it looks like most people from Gen X feel like the majority of young people are useless, right? And I mean, we see what happens to Gen Z, right? Like there are a lot of people among them or kids among them spending too much time in front of screens and all that stuff. But on the other side, like when I hit the gym, for example, there are so many young kids who are very disciplined, who hit the gym all the time, who are there like, I don't know, 4 or 5 times a week. So there are good people among them as well. And I don't think it's a lost generation, but I'd love to get your thoughts on that as well.
I don't think any generation is lost. I mean, that's not the point. The point is, like, how do you want to spend your time? It has nothing to do with someone's judgment on, whether or not video games are useful. When it comes to screen time, I would say video games are probably a better investment than, you know, most television shows or spending time on your phone. The problem with the phone that you don't have with video games is that the phone teaches you to have no attention span. And so when you have no attention span, you cannot study and concentrate in a meaningful way. So that's the danger of the phone. And there's a lot of studies on this. Basically, you know, any child who is under the age of like 14 to 16, like the magic number is like less than 2 hours per day. They need to be on the phone less than 2 hours per day, if that. And the reason for that is because the brain is still forming and they're learning these habits that are going to like go with them into their adult life and their professional life. And if they don't have the ability to concentrate and to really like put in, I forget which scientist it was who talked about the butt time, like sitting on your ass and like studying something. Like if you don't have the wherewithal to do that, you're not going to get very far. Because like a lot of these great problems that people have to face and solve in life are going to be problems that you have to solve alone. You know, there's not necessarily always going to be someone who can, you know, step up and tell you how to do this thing or tell you how to do that thing. And, you know, at the end of the day, if you sacrifice your ability to create via concentration, you're going to be in a bad spot. So like the ultimate skill to have is your ability to learn. And this is a skill. So one of the things that Gen X got from parents who basically worked and left them alone was they had to figure shit out on their own. And so this is where that attitude of like, you know, like Gen X being all things to all people comes from, because not only did we get the people skills, you know, and like the physical skills because we, you know, things were different then. But we also had a healthy dose of technology and a healthy dose of what that meant. So you got the best of both worlds where you had real interactions with real people, then you had digital interactions with digital people. You had the video games, you had the telephone, you had even early cell phones. You had all of this technology that's basically available today with the exception of social media, right? And so when you're looking at the landscape from the lens of like a younger person who doesn't necessarily have you know, like a fully formed brain yet. The frontal, like the front part of the brain doesn't fully form until you're 25 years old. And you teach them to have no attention span, and then you teach them that relationships are digital rather than forcing them or teaching them to have relationships in the real world. You cripple them, and you see this, you know, like my wife consults with a coffee shop, and she's constantly hiring kids, right? And the kids that work there are not the same maturity level as the kids that came before them. And this is another trend that Jonathan Haidt points out in his writings. You know, the age of maturity is getting further and further and further down the line. So if you had like a Gen X kid at 13 or 14 who comes home to an empty house, prepares his own food, you know, maybe watches a little bit of television, you know, has to do homework, or catch up with friends or get on the phone or do some sort of something to get homework done and prepare for the next day, absent mommy and daddy, that mentality is, or that child is much more mature than a child who comes home and mommy has snack on the table and limits what they can and can't do, or allows them to sit on the couch and do nothing, and then, you know, sends that kid off into the world to like ask for a job at the local coffee shop, for example. The maturity level is extremely different. It's noticeably different. And it's not that like Homelanders or, you know, like millennials or whomever, it's not that these people are useless, it's that their experience is different. And you can see it. So, you know, like of the population of kids that work at the shop, there'll be a massive percentage of them who are basically incapable. And then there'll be one or two who really, really stand out because they show up with a great work ethic. They show up with a good attitude. They show up understanding that they're there to serve other people, that, you know, they can't be on their phone every 5.5 seconds. And it's night and day. So like there's, it has less to do with generation and more to do with how a child is reared or parented. And it shows up in massive ways. So like if you want to win against like the younger generation, it's really easy because not very many of them have the wherewithal of previous generations or the stick-to-itiveness or the intestinal fortitude or the skill set. So like if you have parents who give you those things and you're coming up right now, you have a massive advantage over the entire population of people that you'll be competing against.
It's funny that you mentioned that, because just yesterday I spoke to parents of a newborn child, and the mother was like she read a lot of books and all that stuff, and she was like, no one ever taught me how to raise a kid, right? And this kind of reminded me of like what you just said, right? Like the parents are responsible for you know, raising their kids. But I feel like, do you feel like it's gotten harder, you know, to get them away from all the social media stuff, and that they're a lot more, that you need to be a lot more cautious when it comes to raising them?
No.
Compared to the 80s, no. For example.
No. I mean, no? Life has never been easier, safer, you know, more convenient than it is today. And that's the problem. When you don't face hardships and you don't have difficult tasks, you don't learn how to be self-sufficient, and you can't learn confidence. And so when you are in a space where so much is provided for you, or so many things come easy to you, it's a theft. It's a form of theft. You're stealing that person's self-esteem. You're stealing that person's confidence, and you're stealing their ability to learn who they are and what they're about. I mean, there's a reason that in cultures, especially for male children, if you go to, if you travel back in time, we don't really have these rituals anymore in like the modern West. But there was a reason that there was a adulthood ritual in early tribes to delineate between child and man. For example. And this was done because there was a different expectation when you called yourself a man versus calling yourself a boy, right? And when you crossed that threshold, whatever it was, whether you were, you know, like a Spartan child who was sent off into the wilderness to live by yourself for X a number of days or what have you, and you, you know, had to face down whatever was happening in that world and survive on your own. Whether that was your experience or you're an African tribesman who, you know, kidnaps the child from the mother, you know, in this sort of mock kidnapping thing, and then they perform some sort of violent ritual to the child to like let the child know that this is what adulthood is going to be. Like, there's no clear delineation from when you become a man versus staying a child. And this is the problem that we have in Western culture right now. There's no adulthood ritual, so to speak. And when you don't have that, you don't really know, okay, well, what is my, what is my sort of threshold of responsibility as a child versus my threshold of responsibility as an adult? There's no groups of people coming together telling you this is how you are to behave at certain points of life when you acquire this type of responsibility. You know, and so, you know, what a lot of people have done, especially in personal development circles, is they will force hardship upon themselves to see what they're all about. Whether it's, you know, doing some crazy 200-mile hike, or whether it's doing some form of ritual scarification, or some crazy something that basically imprints this moment in time on the mind and says, hey, when you wake up tomorrow, your expectation, or the world is going to have a different expectation of you, and you're going to have a different expectation of yourself. And without that, it's very difficult to know where people lie, especially in the land of maturity. So that difficulty that you face is what's missing. And as long as it continues to be missing, we will continue to see the level of maturity or the rate of maturity slow down. Kids will continue to mature at slower and slower and slower rates. And so the thing that previous generations had that this one doesn't is they faced hard things earlier in life. It's really that simple.
Yeah, absolutely. Many, many good points. Don't know how we got here from gaming, but yeah, we drifted a bit off topic with the whole parenting discussion, but it was definitely an interesting conversation nonetheless. I just wanted to make a cut here and speak about one big news that I got yesterday. You probably read about it as well. We usually do not jump too much into crypto recently, but you've probably read the news about Bitmart, another exchange, a pretty big one, is shutting down. And it's interesting because some users report that they get some kind of FTX flashbacks. Bitmart says users can still withdraw their funds, but if you spend just a few minutes on X or Reddit, you will find a very different story. Users reporting stuck withdrawals, frozen funds, and growing panic. And yeah, whether every report is accurate or not, one thing is pretty clear. Once people lose confidence in an exchange, fear spreads faster than fact. So, have you read about Bitmart and their shutdown?
I didn't read any of the details. Just the fact that, you know, that it was announced that they're shutting down. There's actually a couple that are shutting down before the end of the year. Bitmart is one of them. There's Odos, Django, and BitMEX as well, are all winding down this year. So, I mean, that's again par for the course.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, in the end, that's probably also some kind of consolidation, right? Like, we have the big exchanges like Binance or Coinbase who are probably too big to fail. But in the end, it's interesting to see, you know, another actor failing and another, you know, party who has, like, I've read how many funds did they raise? Like a couple million. And it's crazy to see that this kind of thing keeps happening over and over and over again. Wasn't the first one who shut down its services, is probably not going to be the last one. But is all that, in your opinion, something that signals us that a bottom is forming here in the crypto markets?
Well, I mean, in terms of bottoms, like, who knows, you know, and just like tops, who knows? Like, I mean, at the end of the day, no one has a crystal ball. So I don't necessarily think those things are correlated per se, because again, like, you know, if you go back and you pull, if you go to your favorite AI and you just pull up, hey, you know, give me a list of every, you know, Web3 project that's failed over the last 2 years, you'll have 4, 5, or 6 for every single month, right? And of course, you know, the higher profile ones are the only ones you hear about. But the truth is, like, everything that's not providing value is going away, and it's going away at a faster rate, which is a good thing. Again, just going into consolidation, it could mean that you're forming a bottom, but really what it means is that the marketplace is getting smarter. People are going to go to what provides value, provides the most value, and that's the end of the story. So we can talk about, you know, this exchange or that exchange or the other exchange, but which exchange serves you best is the one that's going to win, you know. There's no doubt in my mind that Coinbase has won the exchange wars. It's far and away the most user-friendly and has the most tentacles into financial markets across the globe. So, you know, there's a couple that are there up there with it, you know, and, you know, maybe you consider Binance to be a good one as well. But the truth is, there's no reason for me to use another exchange outside of the one that I'm currently using, because it does everything I want to do and then some. So all of the exchanges who weren't able to raise the funds or create the technologies or tap into certain aspects of, you know, tokenization with stocks or what have you, they're going to suffer and they're going to fail. And that's just the way it is. It's just part of consolidation.
Yeah, that's true. And it's still fascinating to see how resilient the market is right now, despite all the negative headlines, whether it's exchanges shutting down or a few weeks ago, all the concerns around sales, the price has barely reacted. And it feels like bad news just isn't moving the market the way it used to back then. I mean, good news either, right? Like I remember in 2024, I think it was 2024, when we had the first rumors about a Bitcoin ETF. And, you know, whenever you read about that, you saw a spike in the price movement. And it feels like, you know, the volatility is maybe, I'm not saying it's going away, but it feels like markets have become a lot more resilient. What do you see?
I think people have just gotten smarter. I mean, so you can frame that as resilience or, you know, whatever you want to frame it as. But I mean, at some point, you know, you would like to think that the primates learned the lesson, right? You know, there's patterns to all this stuff. Nothing happening in Web3 is new in terms of market movements. It's all happened before, whether it was real estate or stocks or bonds or whatever the case may be. Big run-ups, big sell-offs, it's all happened before. The challenge that you had in Web3 is that so many people who knew nothing about how markets work always think that the next run-up is the next, you know, massive blow-off top. And it always takes longer than you think. So, you know, I mean, ultimately, it's one of those situations where I think the buyer or the consumer, the participant, whatever you want to call them, is getting a little bit more accustomed to how markets actually work. And that points to a certain level of maturity. So that's a good thing. Market is maturing. But also, you've got retail underpinning all this stuff. So you can look at it from the standpoint of, okay, well, we've had massive sell-offs. Crypto is inevitable at this point. It's not going anywhere. If I'm a big bank or a big investment firm, I need to leverage these sell-offs to take positions because I'm sitting on all this cash and I need to put it somewhere. So, you know, on some level, you've got institutional investors, you know, to some degree, sort of backstopping or underpinning the market, at least for the major tokens. Like, you know, you can't say that that's true for every token, but for at least for the major tokens, that's going to be the case.
Yeah, absolutely. I totally agree. And it's always exciting to watch the markets and see how they react. But let's jump into the Goodfellas for the last couple of minutes too. I have a meeting planned with Daniel, and we'll have a little interview prepared for you guys. So if you're listening to the podcast, the interview should be available by tomorrow. And yeah, it's going to be great. Love the excitement around the Alien Mint. And we've got a couple people who requested a spot on the allow list. So definitely make sure to be there on time on Friday. And we will have a mint party, of course, as always. We will get there together. We will cherish the piece that we got. I'm trying to get some behind the scenes and creation progress information from Daniel to, you know, drop all the information on spaces. And I'm looking forward to the piece. Again, a very unique one, something we haven't had before. And I think Daniel made a really, really good job bringing like the Goodfellas vibe into an Alien piece, right?
Mm-hmm. For sure, yeah. Should be a fun piece. Definitely sticks with his style. People who are in his community collecting, it's going to be riding in the same vein of what you've seen. So we're excited to bring that in and have a little excitement around it, yeah.
Absolutely. And on top of that, Maria is still creating the bonus piece for the World Cup, of course. And Jason dropped the sirens that have been traded for the Artoba tickets. So all these pieces are out, correct?
I think maybe there's one or two more people that they need to go to. But yeah, everyone who submitted, it's all done. I think maybe Chris needs his pieces, maybe one other person for sure. But yeah, it's a done deal, and all those passes are on the burn list, never to be used again. And yeah, so you got a beautiful set of sirens sitting in your wallet. If you haven't checked, be sure and check.
Absolutely, do that, and keep an eye out for Friday. Keep an eye out for all the promo that is leading up to the mint. It's going to be fun. And interview, as I said, is going to drop on Wednesday, most likely. We will drop it onto our website. And that being said, we look forward to Friday. Hope you guys join the spaces. We'll have a good time together. The final mint of July and the final mint for a couple of weeks at least. And do you have any final words for the audience for today, Jason?
I don't think so, man. That was a pretty cool conversation. Definitely looking forward to what's coming up, and looking forward to having a great week. So let's get out there and make it happen.
Absolutely, fellas. So have a great week, everyone. We'll catch you guys on Friday's spaces. We'll have a great mint, and have a good week, everyone. Bye-bye.
Take care, guys.